Coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio, located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation, it's your host, Doug Hagman.
Welcome to Hagman. It is the Hagman Report for today. It is Wednesday, December 7th, 2022. 82 years ago, the bombing of Pearl Harbor by a Japanese force. And, you know, you look at 82 years, the past 82 years, and the reason I bring this up, obviously, the people who perished, the Americans who died at Pearl Harbor, how many have died since because of American lies, because of revisionist history, because of the government keeping information, well, infiltrators in the government keeping information away from the good guys, so to speak, or the bad guy infiltration into our government. We see this today. It is happening more and more and more. It seems like history may not repeat itself, but certainly does rhyme, as the saying goes. Okay. I do want to start out with a couple, just briefly, with a couple of clips from 82 years ago to set the tone, set the stage, to show you where we're at today. We are essentially right there. In my personal research I've done, the attack at Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941, could have been prevented. It was permitted, in my personal research opinion view, by members, infiltrators in the U.S. government, including but not limited to, oh, that hero of the left, FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who is the father, grandfather, godfather of the socialist movement here in America, the communist movement in America. Why do you think we're seeing things today that we're seeing? It's because of FDR and his cabinet, his people, his infiltrators. And one of the people that we had on was Diana West. Her book, American Betrayal. You talk about some great information. And revisionist history, it must be stopped, all right? These taking down of statues, that's all part of it. That's part of the movement. So the colleges, the universities, nothing but indoctrination centers. You know this, I know this. But for new people tuning in, you know, again, go back in history a little bit and understand the hinge moments in time. The hinge moments when, in fact, history changed the trajectory of our country. But that history is, well, it was more of a plot, plan, or scheme by the power brokers, by the infiltrators, by the communist infiltrators in our government. Again, as shown, illustrated, documented by Diana West, by M. Stanton Evans, by other people, other authors, other investigative researchers, historical investigative researchers to get at the truth. So a little bit of a history lesson that allows people to understand where we are today, why we are today, and who brought us here. We're going to go to, if you go, by the way, all of this information is cited and sourced at HagmanReport.com. For today's episode, open up the box and you'll see every citation and resource. And by the way, if folks, here's what I ask you to do. I thank you for your support for this platform, because without it, we could not keep doing what we're doing. Eric the Tech, myself, lady of this, even lady of the studio dog, she appreciates the kibble. Okay. No, I don't feed her kibble, but you know what I'm saying? It all helps. So what I ask you to do is, if you see things that you like, go ahead and please post it on your social networking feed. I am on Gab. I'm on Truth Social. I'm on Parler, and I'm on, what's the other one? Okay. I'm on four social networks. I apologize. I should write this down, shouldn't I? But having said that,
Getter.
Thank you. My goodness.
Getter.
Eric the Tech.
Get her done.
We need to get her done. That's the
one
thing.
Of my favorite.
Get her done.
Get her.
I'll tell you what, it's a good play. They're all good platforms. Now, Twitter, look, Elon Musk, that whole thing's a hot mess. And I don't trust people. I don't trust. We saw what happened, and I'm going to get into this Twitter mess.
I think he's just bored.
You know, if you had like all the money, gazillions of dollars, I mean, what would you do with it?
You would have fun like that.
I guess, right? You're awful talkative today. You want to do the show?
No.
Oh, come on, brother. You can do it. Folks, Eric the Tech, guy that refuses to be seen on camera.
Could do a whittling tutorial.
He was actually whittling today for a reason. I can't. He was shaving a piece of wood in order for this piece of wood to fit into a box that, never mind, it doesn't matter. You get the idea. You look like Jed Clampett on the Beverly Hillbillies whittling there.
It's my evening job.
Yes. 82 years ago, you know, my father fought in the Pacific Theater of Operation during World War II. And I think back to the few conversations I have had with my father about the war. And I think back, of course, the iconic imagery of the storming of the beaches of Normandy, how many young men went to their deaths and for what? And then the, you know, General Patton and many things about World War II. As an extension of World War One, and folks, I would urge you, sincerely urge you, to really understand history. So a little bit of history first. This is on December 8th. This would be 82 years ago tomorrow. FDR, that SOB, FDR, that SOB, but nonetheless, declaring war against Japan. But this is two segments from the same video. Again, go to Hagman, two ends on Hagman, HagmanReport.com. And the original source video will be there if you wish to view the entire source. It's cited properly, and it's there for you. Go ahead and play segment one of video one.
President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives. Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense, but always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us.
You know, one has to ask the question, why at this time in history were our naval assets parked like Lincoln Logs or parked at the Hawaiian Islands all together? I mean, why? If
vacation,
right. There it is, vacation. It is a question that some people, historians, will answer one way, others another way. Of course, you know, we didn't expect anything. Well, during the late...
Do you know the reason for that?
They were instructed to do so by the commander-in-chief, ultimately by the commander-in-chief, that being FDR, going through some admirals and through the chain of command to park, again, just set up like, you know, targets that they were there. It boggles the mind. That would be like, well, I don't think anyone needs any kind of analogy when we talk about this. So here is the war proclamation. This is segment two of video one, declaring war on Japan. And of course, his full speech was less than 5 minutes that day. But here is the end of that speech. Here it is.
I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
You know, one wonders how many leftists and neocons got woodies and people who were connected with the military-industrial complex got, you know, really became excited. Hey, we're going to war, right? With that declaration. And you heard that really robust round of applause. Now, look, I'm not saying that if attacked, don't go to war. But what I am saying is don't set yourself, your country, the innocents up to be killed as the pretext to go to war, to feed the military-industrial complex, which is what is happening today. Again, history may not repeat itself, but it certainly does rhyme, and we're seeing that rhyming today. Now, look, it was during the winter months of the previous year and into the spring and summer when Americans, when our intelligence, American, the War Department, it wasn't the Department of Defense, but the War Department, and other agencies, we were able to intercept and decode Japanese cables that laid out, perfectly laid out, the plans of attack against our military. Now, think about that. We knew in advance And many historians, many people will say that's a BS conspiracy theory. Well, my response to you is how many of those conspiracy theories over the last, 100 years have come true? Most of them. The burden of proof, I believe now, is on the people who call us conspiracy theorists. You prove your case. We don't have to prove ours. I think there's sufficient proof to prove ours. There's a second video here. Now, I'm not endorsing any specific, in this episode, any specific theory, except the fact that we indeed intercepted and decoded the transmissions of the Japanese. And some people will poo-poo that. In fact, in this same video, there was somebody that came out and said, too many people would have to know about it. Well, when you're infiltrated by communists, by enemies of the state, by enemies of the American people, I guess in some ways it doesn't matter. But the true answer to that is not really. No, if you silo the information as has happened over the last number of years, including and throughout 9/11, the need to know the siloing of information, you can get away with this. I want to play about 4 minutes of segment one, video two, about the Pearl Harbor attack. And one of the theories behind the knowledge that we had, how we had it, who had it, and how kind of everything went, led up to World War II. And again, this is, you might ask, its relevance to today, because again, this is the same template that we're seeing, whether it be Ukraine, Russia, war with Russia. You know there are neocons, liberals, and leftist communists that are just drooling for us to get into a proxy war with, or we're already in a proxy war, but get into a hot war with Russia and even China. You know that. Military-industrial complex, the various components thereof. That's what's happening today. So let's look back in history at this specific event 82 years ago today. Again, my father, and I'm sure many people listening to this, your fathers fought in that war. Some died. My uncle was shot and ultimately died from his wounds, buried in Arlington. All over really lies. But watch this. This is segment one, video two.
Diplomatic cable from Japanese High Command arrived at the Office of Naval Intelligence in Washington. Some months previously, America had cracked Japan's secret codes. It meant that cryptographers were able to decipher a coded message sent from Tokyo to its spies in Hawaii. That missive has since become known as the bomb plot message. After the war, the Congressional Committee examined the bomb plot message. Officers questioned about it had passed it off as unremarkable at the time. But the committee heard one general testify that the bomb plot message was in fact unique. Of the thousands of decoded Japanese cables, only this one asked for specific locations of ships at anchor.
The bomb plot's intelligence specifically asked for the dispositions of the warships and airplanes guarding Pearl Harbor. The obvious intent of the bomb plot's intelligence was to place a grid over Pearl Harbor so that pilots flying in would immediately be able to identify the targets.
American couriers sent the deciphered message to the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Harold Stark, and then to the Army Chief of Staff, General George Marshall. Then, According to Hill, the top secret message went to President Roosevelt.
FDR was making all the decisions. Every historian understands that FDR was reading all of the U.S. intelligence decrypts of Japanese coded transmissions.
I know.
Two men in particular could make immediate use of the information. Admiral Husband Kimmel and Lieutenant General Walter Short, the commanders at Pearl Harbor. But they never received it. According to Hill, that was not an accident.
If FDR and his administration deliberately withheld the vital intelligence from Pearl Harbor, and all the evidence indicates that they did, then it was certainly a deliberate conspiracy to set Pearl Harbor up for a total defeat.
There are other researchers who support Hill's extraordinary hypothesis. They allege the key to understanding exactly what Roosevelt and other officials knew, and at what point they knew it, lies within the United States code-breaking operation.
Breaking the Japanese military codes was America's great secret of World War II.
All agree that, sometime before Pearl Harbor, the U.S. had broken the Japanese diplomatic codes. But in 2000, Robert Stinnett completed almost 20 years of research by publishing his findings, which conclude that America had also cracked the top secret operational codes of the Japanese Navy. According to Stinnett, this proves that Roosevelt's closest military advisors must have known when and where the attack would occur.
The fact that we broke it, we knew what Japan was up to. We knew it before Pearl Harbor. We knew it all through the war. We knew where Japan's ships were going to be, what their plans were to be.
Stinnett's evidence includes two U.S. naval dispatches. In a memo sent in October 1940, over a year before Pearl Harbor, Rear Admiral Royal Ingersoll, the Assistant Chief of Naval Operations in Washington, documented the progress of his code-breaking team. This secret cable to his specific commanders referred to the Japanese naval operational codes. It read, "It is estimated that at least 6 months will be required before complete messages can be read."
He said that we had broken the Japanese operations code.
If Ingersoll's timetable was accurate, America should have been able to decrypt secret Japanese naval correspondence by the spring or summer of 1941.
The smoking gun of Pearl Harbor is the breaking of the Japanese naval code. And it's only until recently, when I filed Freedom of Information Act requests with the Navy, that I got these records, and including the officer in charge who actually broke the code and confirmed it.
That officer in charge was Lieutenant Commander John Leetweiler. He and his 75-man code-breaking team labored inside an impregnable tunnel cut into a mountainside on the island of Corregidor in the Philippines.
So let me ask you a question. Okay, how much documentation is being hidden today? Now, you saw, that's one aspect of the foreknowledge of the attack, okay, how that all came about. So think about it today. Here we are. You have 9/11 in more recent times. Well, you even go back to Oklahoma City, the first World Trade Center bombing, 9/11, and so on. So to have an intellectual discussion with one of your relatives, friends, coworkers, neighbors, or whatever, who believe everything the government tells you, and that's going to come up here momentarily, why what's taking place is taking place in terms of, I believe the government over everything else, and I believe mainstream media, why this is happening. Okay, think about that. Think about what that author said about the essentially hiding the information behind national security, or for national security reasons. And remember the Kennedy assassination. Remember that. One of the most pivotal moments in American history, and Donald Trump himself would not release the documents that are still being held in secret. Okay, some 59 years after the incident. Why? Ask yourself why. Well, he said to Judge Napolitano, if you read what I read, you wouldn't release them either. So tell me, what do they say? Who do they implicate? And what effect, what impact would they have on Americans today? One more less than a minute segment of the same video. Again, this is segment two, video two, in the show notes at HagmanReport.com to wrap this up. Here it is.
In September 1944, shortly before Roosevelt stood for re-election for the fourth time, a Republican representative, Forrest Harness of Indiana, made the first congressional charge alleging a Pearl Harbor conspiracy. He said that 3 days prior to the attack, the Australian government had warned Washington that a Japanese aircraft carrier was steaming towards Hawaii, but the information was withheld from Kimmel and Short. Charges of this sort had been in the air for a long time, but the Indiana legislators' allegation entered them permanently into the public record. They have been the source of controversy ever since.
That word was controversy. I had to listen to it twice, but okay, so bring this to the present. Boy, it was read into the congressional record, people, but what was done about it? Was there anything done about it? Which is why today, for example, we have information about the origins, about the Wuhan, the Chinese Communist Party virus. Compare that to what happened in 41, in 44. Hey, this is all being written in the record. You've got Rand Paul reading the Riot Act to Fauci. What's being done about this? Nothing happened in 44. No one was held to account in 44. So are we to expect something different? History says, no. Now, one of my favorite people is Dinah West. She brought this to not Pearl Harbor, but the infiltration of our government, which is where we are today. The infiltration of our government, NGOs, various government agencies, cabinets, and the whole shebang. They are infiltrated by communists, by these World Economic Forum slugs who want to take over the world, who want to take down the United States. So, again, think back to 44. Reddit, look, we got this information. Here it is. I can show you. Hey, everybody. Hey, all the reps. Here we go. Look, see? They knew. They knew about this attack. There was foreknowledge. And with foreknowledge comes complicity. It's the same thing today, isn't it? Same thing.
Conspiracy.
Ah, give me my tinfoil cap. I got to find that. But see, America is a captured operation. So when everyone gets excited, gets that shot of hopium in them, oh, it's going to be different this time. I can't wait until Congress changes. Well, wait a second. I can't wait till the red wave. Oh, no red wave. Wonder why that was. Huh. Still using the same machines and this and lip service. No action. Huh. Boy, that's a stumper, isn't it? Okay. You see where I'm going with this? So has anything changed? No. Now, I'm going to take you back to almost a decade ago. Dinah West wrote American Betrayal. I have my copy in my office. I don't have it here with me. And she was talking about the infiltration in America. Now, this is about a 2-minute segment. I want you to watch this. Again, this is a decade ago now, roughly 9-10 years ago, where Diana West was speaking at a specific event. This book, when her book came out, American Betrayal. And by the way, I recommend, highly recommend, everyone gets a copy of American Betrayal if you don't have that already. It's good for your Christmas list. There's a lot of great information there. There's 951 footnotes in that book. And I've got to tell you, she's right on the money. But the infiltration, the communist infiltration into our government, she talks about this. And she talks about the origins of it, especially around World War II. But from the Soviets, from the USSR at that time perspective. But it doesn't matter. It's the same. But she talks about it. Now, again, think what, 2011-ish? Think what was going on back then as you listen to Diana West. This clip is only about 2.5 minutes. Here it is.
There were purges of anti-communist records during World War II. There were purges of anti-communist personnel. The Soviet foreign minister in 1943 actually presented a list to the United States government of anti-communist officials at the State Department. I'm going to pause so everyone can absorb anti-communist officials at the State Department. They did exist until about this point when they were purged. They were sent away. They were sent to places like Iraq and Turkey, which were not hotspots during World War II, and they were sent to Canada just to be out of the vicinity. One of President Roosevelt's emissaries, diplomatic emissaries during the war, a man named George Earl, the former Pennsylvania governor, he had come to the point where he realized that the Soviet Union was supplanting Nazi Germany with an even more totalitarian or even more dangerous dictatorship. And when he discussed this with Roosevelt and wanted to bring it to the public's attention, he was redeployed to Samoa for the duration. So this is how things were done. If we flash forward to the future, to our time in 2011, we had similar pressures brought to bear by Muslim groups on the president's counterterrorism at the time advisor John Brennan, the Justice Department, Department of Homeland Security, eliminate anti-Islamic materials, quote anti-Islamic, the trainers. It was kind of a parallel. Strange parallel to be living through again. Another parallel in the olden days during World War II, officials were very worried about being offensive to Russians, offensive to Soviets. We have a mirror image today in the fears of being offensive to Islam, offensive to Muslims. But we called that victory. We called that victory back then. And I just wondered as I was looking at all this material, what kind of victory for liberty replaces one totalitarian monster with an even greater one. This is what happened when the Soviet Union supplanted Nazi Germany with its evil empire in Europe. And it took about 40 years for a president even to say the words evil empire. And it was like the world exploded with this extremely banal statement. It should have been something almost in passing, but it froze. It froze the debate because no one was supposed to notice. Now we claim, or we used to claim, I don't even know if we remember, but we claimed victory in a Cold War after a communist century that left 100 million people dead under communist regimes, according to the Black Book of Communism. And today, Republicans in Congress, they have the majority. They can't muster the votes to defund what comes down to socialized medicine. So ideologically, who won? Who won? In the Senate this week, sovereign borders are not even a point of debate. Citizenship is essentially worthless. The Constitution is in tatters. And you start sort of seeing a resemblance more to the sort of dream of Marxism-Leninism than anything else. And so again, but we call it victory. We're very happy to call it victory. And you just wonder what it's all about.
Change a few words there. And she could have said that today. You see, who won World War II? Did you hear when she said, by the way, 100 million dead under communism? What do you think the objective is of this one world government, new world order, party of Davos, World Economic Forum? You know exactly what the intent is. It's to kill us. That's the intent. And by the way, you heard the president, the governor of Pennsylvania, Earl, was sent to Samoa. Eric the Tech, I'm going to have to, because you know too much, you're going to be transferred to Samoa next week, effective next week. Bring somebody else in.
Tatters.
In tatters, yeah. Our constitution's in tatters. But socialized medicine, that went through. How many people understand? I just went through, by the way, my insurance. What a nightmare that is, folks. You know what we're trying to get insurance right now. Obama, the Obama regime, along with the rhinos, along with the infiltrators in Congress, allowed this Obamacare. You, of course, John McCain, that, you know what I'm talking about with insurance. They broke the medical system, but they also took over 25% of our economy in doing so. And I'm telling you right now, that is their intent. That's not a bug, but a feature. And anyone out there, and I feel for you, because I'm going through the same thing, fighting with my insurance company, changing insurance policies, paying. Look, I've got to pay because, well, I mean, it's no secret. I'm going through some stuff, okay? But my insurance is being raised $5,000 a year. Being raised $5,000. You know what I'm saying? That's communism. As some people will say, well, no, that's corporate greed. No. To play by the rules that were insinuated into the system by Obama, Barack Hussein, Barry Sitaro, got a big one in my mouth, Obama, according to Larry Sinclair. And his people, they did that. All right. Segment two. This is a wrap up of Diana West again. Same venue, same time period, almost a decade ago, and has some lessons, has some end notes, if you will, for us today. And then we're going to move right into how this all affects all of us, what how that this whole foundation was laid. And it's continuing, and even to some extent, hopefully, how we can break it. But watch this.
Just because I know I make some very controversial claims, but I did get an email that crystallized the whole thing. The man who heard me on the radio, it was very long interview, it was about 3 hours, if you can imagine that. And he wrote and he said, essentially, you are saying that all of post-1930 American geopolitical World War II and Cold War history, as it has been presented, is a fiction. And it was one of those moments where you have to sort of say, well, yes, I mean, I took a lot longer. I said it in much more flowery language and with many more anecdotes and footnotes. But that's essentially what I'm saying, trying to explain how that could happen. It's such an amazing claim, but I'm trying to explain how it happened and also demonstrate that I think it's happening again. I think that you watch the people coming up and being smacked down, derided, isolated. You know, the public square sorts out the narratives that may go on unimpeded, and people tend to tell them. And I'm also trying to explain why it's so hard to untell these kinds of lies. And I think pushback comes from the establishment, from the left, that can't stand the unraveling of the great Roosevelt and the socialist state that he fostered. It comes from establishment right, doesn't want to reveal their silence and their complicity, doesn't want to reveal the shared guilt with many of Soviet war crimes, indeed, crimes against humanity. Too much subversion, I think, too much deception. I mentioned Stanton Evans earlier. One thing he told me, I consider him my mentor, and one thing he told me during my research was, when you read a document that you read a long time ago, and you come back to it after you've been studying elsewhere, it will always look different, and you will always see something new. And this was very useful advice. And I would like to relate that to something that I read early on in my research. It was an anecdote from Vladimir Bukovsky, the Soviet ex-Soviet dissident, who was writing about 2008 or so in Cato magazine, and he was writing about his experience under the first Russian president Yeltsin, who had sent him into these archives to construct a case, a Nuremberg-style trial of communism, not the individuals, because he said that would be, you know, trials of 19 million people, but no, the system. They were going to try the system, and he was in the archives copying with whatever technology he had around the early 90s, copying. It seems that everyone who goes in the archives knows they've got a copy because they all sensed it would close, and so it did. But Bukovsky was in there trying to build this case, and at a certain point Yeltsin came to him and said, I'm calling it off. We're not going to do it. And Bukovsky said, why? And Yeltsin said, let me show you. And he showed him these cables. He said, I'm getting so much pressure from the West not to do it. And that was it. And when I first read this some years ago, I could not understand it. But now I feel that it makes a lot more sense. Our elites, anyway, don't want to know the truth. The phony narratives become more important than the truth, than the facts, than changing things, than rearranging their understandings, rearranging their assessments of their own behavior or our own past. And anything becomes expendable to that, whether it's truth, the country, the people, the men at war, the truth tellers who are left twisting. I was struck by a comment Solzhenitsyn made in evident frustration. He wrote, it is as if the West actually does not want to know the truth until the moment when this knowledge has ceased to be of use. Now, I'm hoping he's wrong. I'm hoping we can learn these truths, even if they do break our hearts, as some of them do, because they're still very much of use to us. They do.
Pretty interesting statement that she made, the elites, and I think what she meant to say was the elites don't want us to know the true history. And that email that she received saying that the history that we have been taught, that we have learned, that has been written really from World War II onward, and I would argue even earlier than that, is a lie, just as it is today. And then she mentioned too how records would disappear from the National Archives. Boy, what a rabbit trail I went down when I saw that. Everyone knows Sandy Bergler, right? Or Sandy Berger, the theft from the National Archives back in 2003. You know, 58-year-old Sandy Berger, the former National Security Advisor under Bill Clinton. Bill, I did not have sex with her, Clinton.
Tatters.
Tatters. Yeah, they, I'll tell you. Devil with the blue dress on, right?
Tatter tots.
Tatter tots. We should, there we go. We should make tater tots, kind of wrap them up in the Constitution and rename them tatter tots. There you go. Something like that. But, you know, Sandy Berger, after in the Clinton administration, what did he do? He went to the archives and he snuck out papers. He walked out of the National Archives in Washington, D.C. He had papers stuffed in his underwear and his socks and every place else. He was sentenced to 100 hours of community service. Yeah, boy, that hurt. And probation. He was also fined $50,000. Yeah, so he lost his security clearance and license to practice law. But in addition to that, okay, when I was looking at the thefts from the National Archives, and this is just kind of a PS or a end note here, some notable thefts from the National Archives: Robert Bradford Murphy and his wife in 63. There was a theft of documents, Charles Morrell Mount in 1987, Sean Awitz in 2002, of course, burglar in 03. And then you've got several more stealing from the National Archives. All right. But okay. So what does that have to do with today? What does that have to do with, like, you know, where you're at and what you're doing right now today? Well, one of the things that has been kept from us, and imagine if we had Twitter or the internet during World War II, it would have gone down, I'm sure. But imagine if we had social media platforms during World War II. One of the big stories here, we talk about infiltration. I saw a headline yesterday. The Communist Chinese Party must have something over Joe Biden. Hello, is this thing on? I've written for Wisconsin Christian News numerous articles about Hunter Biden's laptop that prove Joe Biden's involvement in deals, energy deals, and other deals in Ukraine, in China, and his 10% for the big guy. It's all proved in that laptop. And no, that's not Russian disinformation. But Elon Musk had showed that that information was censored from the American public prior to the 2020 election. Now, you may say, well, that really didn't have any. It doesn't matter what we think. Okay. The fact that it was done is unforgivable. Rights, and this in the show notes is page 1, Hunter Biden's laptop equals the Rosenbergs. Now, I agree with this. This is from Diana West. This is published back, just last Saturday. Okay. And she writes, we have a new Rosenbergs. His name or its name is Hunter Biden's laptop. And again, just for the FBI listening out there, and I know you are, for DHS listening out there, and I know you are, I do have a complimentary copy of Hunter Biden's complete laptop for you on your way out for your swag bag. All right.
And some tater tots.
And some tater tots. Oh, eat those, baby. Boy, I wish I wouldn't have spit in that latte. Okay, yeah. Like the Rosenbergs, the Hunter Biden laptop is a touchstone or better catch-all for the existential national security threats that struck at this nation to the coup of 2020, in which the presidential election was stolen from the people. That's you and me. In a conspiracy so immense, we can't talk about that conspiracy. We can't talk about that coup that installed this Joey Two Scoops, my two Joeys, whatever you want to call that, whatever, Biden-Harris cluster. Okay. That installed an illegitimate regime run by we not know what power. We do know it has that WEF, this globalist party of Davos puppet strings. We know that. And I'm sure we could whittle it down to probably a couple hundred people in control over this planet that need a dirt nap. That's my view. But beyond that, But we can talk about the Hunter Biden laptop. And now, with a gusher of false scent, and this is a very interesting statement, Elon Musk's Twitter has leaked or released the Hunter Biden laptop story. Look that away, sheeple. And only that away, sheeple. That's just what they want you to do. And then she writes, what about your laptop, your Apple laptop, mine too? You've got to really consider the weight of the words here and the fact that it's comparative to the Rosenbergs. Because we know, now we know, suppression of history redux. Now perhaps you can understand why I led up to the right now where I'm at, because all of a sudden you see last week, and we went over this earlier this week, met Tabby from the Rolling, the investigative journalist, had gone through that entire release of documents from Twitter about the suppression of the Hunter Biden laptop, laying it right in the lap of that Indian woman, right? I talked to John Moore about this on Monday. And the attorney, and she was fired forthwith. But now we find out, in this is page 3, suppression of history redux, that's what I'll call it. Elon Musk fires Twitter general counsel. Who? James Baker. Gee, does that name ring a bell to me? You know what? Let me do this. Before we go to that page, let's go back to Hunter Biden's laptop, the Rosenbergs. I didn't finish with that. And I'm not going to do this justice. Because she adds, Dinah West, I'm going back to the Rosenbergs article here. Writes Dinah West, recently a Fox News reporter in red coat did the walk and talk in silence with Apple CEO Tim Cook. And this is important for people, again, to understand. When he arrived at Capitol Hill this week, she walked and talked. Do you support the Chinese people right to protest? Tim Cook, silence. Do you regret restricting airdrop access to that protesters used to evade surveillance from the Chinese government? Tim Cook, silence. Remember, this is the mope that runs Apple, right? Do you think it's problematic to do business with the Chinese Communist Party when they suppress human rights? Silence, silence, silence. And then what happened when Cook met our elected officials? Turns out the cook was in town for quiet meetings, she writes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I agree with that. You see, no pushback. And again, think back to 41, 44. Think back to 44. Think back just a few years ago, a few months ago. A lot of smoke, no fire, a lot of hat, no cattle, with Fauci and friends. But this, again, is about Hunter Biden's laptop. Now, she writes another Fox report, totally devoid of Cook's failure to answer questions about Apple's CCP crackdown in progress. And by the way, don't forget, Apple's got all the majority of their manufacturing facilities where? In communist China. It perhaps gave us a window on what they talked about, how to move the story away from the silly red coat reporter questions about the Chinese dictatorship's QR tyranny Apple put in place to Elon Musk, the Twitter and App Store. How else did the story of Apple in Congress during this week of massive state aggression against the people of China become a story about how Jim Jordan et al. Would certainly not like it if Twitter was barred from the Apple App Store? She writes, oh, yeah, you know, Apple CEO Tim Cook is the first major tech leader to take the temperature of the incoming tech hostile GOP House. That, you know what, that remains to be seen in my view. We'll see how that goes. Meeting with several Russian leaders in Washington this week, but the quiet meetings, as she phrased them, will provide the first indication of how lawmakers plan to handle tech giants. At center stage, of course, is Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio, who will chair the House Judiciary Committee and could oversee critical antitrust debates regarding Apple's App Store and Amazon, among other things. Cook's aim to establish a relationship was only complicated after Twitter's CEO Elon Musk claimed Apple was threatening to remove the platform from the App Store. That's the way to do it. And again, 44, you saw it in 44, entered in the record, bang, record. So what? Gone. I mean, essentially nothing happens. Now, Musk confirmed in a tweet Wednesday night that things have been smoothed over. However, sharing a tweet, this is last week now, sharing a video from inside Apple's California headquarters. Thanks, Tim Cook, for taking me around Apple's beautiful headquarters, he wrote. Good conversation, among other things. We resolved the misunderstanding about Twitter potentially being removed from the App Store. Tim was clear that Apple was never considered doing so. Okay. Ever get the feeling that could be us someday? She writes. I love the way she writes. And you have to read the article again. It's it would be video or it'd be page one, Hunter Biden's laptop. But going back to what happened this week with the Hunter Biden story, Matt Taibbi came out again. And when you saw that, what was missing from that? Well, what was missing from that, the Twitter files, and this is, this would be page three. Page two, I'm sorry. Suppression of History Redux. Elon Musk fires Twitter General Counsel James Baker for manipulating and filtering Twitter file release. And by the way, his explanation for doing so, that was unconvincing. You see, you can have it in paper form in the archives, Sandy Bergler taking it out and changing the archival history forever, or you can just press the delete key a few times like Jim Baker did, and James Baker, folks, understand this mope's history. But writes in the page two, Suppression of History Redux, what I call it. Yesterday, writes Sundance, we speculated publicly, the first set of Twitter files released was heavily pre-filtered by internal stakeholders connected to DHS who hold a vested interest in controlling any evidence of Twitter's former political activity. And knowing that there are multiple executives remaining within the company who previously aligned with the intents of government. Now, this is important, specifically DHS officials to control the platform. The prediction was not a stretch. Indeed, it just made common sense. So former FBI chief legal counsel James Baker, a man of notoriously corrupt disposition, was one of the former government officials who started working for Twitter as general counsel. So you know the revolving door aspect of this, right? You work for the government and then you're spun out after you're used up at the government and have your creds, you know, you get your street creds there. And then you go into work for, Twitter, whatever, right? That's how this whole thing works. And that's exactly what FBI Chief Legal Counsel James Baker did. This corrupt deposition, this man of corrupt disposition, I should say, was one of those former government officials who started working for Twitter as general counsel. And you can see him on your screen, that maggot. Okay. He was working as a government mechanism for filtration of damaging information. And that's just common sense. Now, today is an outcome of internal discoveries that indeed Baker did pre-filter internal documents. Really, it's like this. Release all the documents. Okay, except the ones I don't want to release, because that would show what? It would show government, the government's hand in social media. It would expose internal documents to sunlight. We can't have that. The article does go into Matt Taibbi's report. The big picture. Let's go right to the big picture. The Twitter files are a threat vector to a bigger story. This is the takeaway right now in the final moments. I can't believe. Is it in the final moments? Okay. I'll end with this. The Twitter files, because again, history, not necessarily repeats, but rhymes. The Twitter files are a threat vector to a bigger story. The DHS, the DOJ, the FBI, the ODNI, U.S. government elements who operated with control over the social media platform did so as an outcome of larger surveillance state, the larger surveillance state. That surveillance state was deployed against Donald Trump in 2016, and everything as an outcome of that failed effort of that failed effort and the ongoing cover-up effort is what surrounds the current DOJ effort against you and against me and against Trump and everyone out there running for office on the conservative platform and the Constitution of the United States. May God bless every one of you. Have a great day, great night, wherever you might be.